Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Do you like Sheffield Live? Why not become a friend of Sheffield Live? Sheffield Live is a community radio station, and friends of Sheffield Live are people in the community who make a regular donation to keep Sheffield Live on the air. Join the Friends of Sheffield Live by writing to friends@sheffieldlive.org or go online to sheffieldlive.org/friends.
Hello, good evening. Here we are again. It's a Wednesday live in Sheffield. It's Deserted Island Discs. So tonight I've got a guest I've been looking forward to having on the show for a long time. He was one of the first supporters of the show. So it's Mike Walsh. Good evening, Mike.
Good evening, Ben. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Yeah, no, I'm honestly really looking forward to having you on the show. I've known you, well, on and off for 30 years, isn't it?
Since we were children.
Yes. So we've got a lot in common, me and Mike. So we're both born in Manchester.
Yeah.
Of Irish heritage.
Yeah, mum and dad.
We were both, we met through work, didn't we, first of all? And it was probably about 1995 when you were working for Irish Community Care.
I left Sheffield in 1996, the first attempt.
You left Manchester, yeah.
No, oh, I was in Sheffield. As a student, never left.
Oh, right.
So until 1996, then I went back to Manchester. So it was about
97. So, I mean, what we like to do, so Deserted Island Discs is the story of your life, Mike, mm-hmm. and we go through and we do songs and... Mm-hmm. We'll get through the hour, and it's going to be a really quick hour because I've just already got so much I want to ask Mike and what we're going to get through. But you're a flute player, and you've been successful in life and career, and we're going to discover all that in the next hour.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give the audience some context, really, is that you've been really successful in your career and life, and things have been going well. There's been ups and downs along the way.
Yeah.
But what we do, we start at the beginning. So, right. Tell us about the beginning.
Beginning, I was born in St Mary's Hospital in the centre of Manchester, and to Pat and Nelly. Dad was from Mayo, bless him, he died a few years ago. Mum, Nelly, is still going, she's from Carvan.
All right.
And we did a couple of years in Leven June, which is like the
33rd the Irish Quarter. Yeah.
And then they got notions, as they say, and moved out to Heaton Chapel.
Moved down the road, Stockport Road.
Yeah, went up to Leafy Heaton Chapel.
Yes, yeah.
With Sebedy Thatches and Gardens. So that's I grew up in Heaton Chapel, Stockport.
Yeah, yeah.
Went to Catholic school.
How did your mum and dad meet?
They met at the Astoria Ballroom in Manchester.
Right.
And, that was 1957, 1958.
So that's probably...
Dad was a great dancer. And he had sparkly eyes.
So she was drawn to him.
Yeah.
But, so was that like an Irish night, an Irish get-together? Was that part of that?
Well, Astoria Ballroom was basically an Irish dance hall.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the one, the Coogans, you know, Steve Coogan.
Yeah, yeah.
It'd be his granddad.
Okay.
Ran that one, owned that one. So there was two or three. There was the Astoria, there was the Bamba Blarney. Anyways, so that's where they met. It was an Irish ballroom. And then pretty soon had my sister and then had me.
Right, right. And what did your parents do?
My dad was... He was a ganger on the building sites.
Worked
for Murphy's and Kennedy's, all the classic stuff.
Yeah.
And then a subsidiary of BK, so Kilpatrick, Balfour Kilpatrick.
Yeah.
So Cable Lane ganger. Right, now, lads, pull!
Yeah.
He used to go out in the summers, work useless, working on the building sites, so they're making tea.
So you had a go?
I had a go, yeah, in the summers. All the gangers, lads, would go out and they'd make us tea, and then they'd just take the pee out of us and get us doing stupid things like, right, lads, come on, fill that wheelbarrow with sand and what, go up that ramp, and they'd just set up a ramp for no reason apart from seeing us wobbling up this thing. But it was good too, because it was money for us. So that's what Dad did.
Did that kind of teach you that, I don't want to do that, kind of?
Dad said to me, listen, I got a bit of a taste for it in the last summer when I finished at Sheffield, when I graduated after my degree.
It's a bit older.
And I went working on the sites, but I had a great thing. Doncaster Prison was being built, and they needed someone for insurance purposes to drive to Doncaster Prison and look at a big cable. And if anyone came to try and nick it, I'd have to ring the police or something. It was an insurance thing, basically.
Yeah,
like, so I got to know all the local lads who were doing scrapping and everything else, and I said, this is what I've got to do, but I don't want any hassle. And they said, no, it's too big, that cable.
Yeah, we're not nicking that.
No, it's too big, so it's fine. So I had a great summer, and I got a taste of it. Then it was Dad sacked me at the end of the summer. He went, this is all right.
Yeah, but don't get used to it. You could do better.
Well, yeah, but it was. He just said it in the winter, and also, yeah, you could do better, all that education.
Yeah. So. Good. I just saw you were going to say about your mum, I think, was you?
Mum's from Carvan. On her, I think their wedding certificate, she was down as a Wellington bootmaker in Dunlop's. But she ended up working for social services, so she was a home help. She used to work with old people.
Yeah.
So she did that. They worked very, very hard. And they play hard too. They were involved in Irish community activities. They went to the dances, up to the Irish centres, the Catholic clubs. Mum was involved in the Cavern Association in Manchester. They took us to dancing and music lessons. Cultus, the local Irish Musicians Association branch in Hume.
Yeah.
During the late 70s, early 80s, it was an interesting spot. All the dads outside saying, Wilfred's looking out, minding the cars.
Yeah.
It was a bit wild.
It was Hume near Moss Side, wasn't it?
It's Hume, Moss Side, it was like another world, go from Heaton Chapel and then you drive through Hume. And it was a clearance place. They'd put people in there in the 60s.
Yeah.
And then I just do remember the that was sort of the start of New Age Travellers around about that time.
Yeah, yeah.
Those people in the big vans parked up. Like, it was an amazing place. But yeah another world every Saturday morning. And then we get into St Wilfrid's, and then our teacher, Marion Flannery, would be there. And
Tim Whistle. So you started at an early age, yeah.
That
was one of my questions when you first did it.
Eight or nine, right. We used to go down there, and I was a bit of a slow starter. Couldn't concentrate.
Right.
As I found out last year, very on trend, I've got severe ADHD. But my teacher used to, and I've learnt from this, for my teaching this, she was really entertaining. She stuck with me, and she used to engage with me.
Yeah.
She just knew how to keep me on track. Yeah. Like, she'd do daft little, we used to have them, you know, them sort of flat deck tape recorders.
And okay.
She'd record a tune into it for us to learn by ear. But okay. She'd put some daft message.
And so you could take it home and...
Yeah.
So we should say that. So you teach tin whistle and flute, is it?
Tin whistle, flute, low whistles.
Yeah. Yep.
So I teach privately at home. I've been teaching on and off at the university.
Yeah.
Just finished a doctorate there. And I've got them up and running again, whistles clubs. So I do one at home and one starting a week on Wednesday at 6:45 at the Dog and Partridge on Triple A. Connor and Sarah really supportive. In fact, Connor's learning.
Oh,
it's hilarious.
That'd be funny, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Connor's been on the show.
He's brilliant, really supportive. And in the little snug. And brilliant. Everyone welcome, beginners. It's more of a social thing.
Yeah.
You're learning, but in a group situation. So I love teaching. I love all my academic work and all the other stuff, but with a passion, I come away fired up after teaching, whether it's one-to-one, a beginner, or right up there at the top level.
So, position. Anyone that's kind of even... thinking of picking it up can come along to these, or
need a £7 tin whistle.
Right.
You can get the. There's a,
is that in weight, is it?
No. £7. A D whistle. D penny whistle, they used to call it. And
it'll cost you £7 to buy it, is it?
Yeah. I think you can get them in most of the music shops, or you can get them in. The Big Whistle is based in Sheffield, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
So that you can go up there and. Just near the university.
Brilliant. Well, Mike's going to play his some songs later on live. He's got a range of flutes and whistles and another thing there that I don't know the name of. But
that's a halusi from Shanghai.
Halusi from Shanghai.
There you go.
Yeah, yes. I want you to play that later on, please.
Yeah.
We'll have a go. But to start with, it's time for a song. So we've gone for the Margot song first.
Yeah.
This makes sense. Just tell us why you picked that and I'll get it ready.
When I was growing up, but before I heard traditional music, really, because Mum and Dad weren't musicians, before I heard traditional music, the music in the house was country and Irish, and that is Irish music, you know.
Yeah.
It's the most popular music in Ireland, it's the biggest seller in Ireland.
Yeah.
And I had no snobbery about it then. Did for a while, don't now. Love it, really. Nostalgic for it. So we listened to country and Irish music, and we listened to rebel songs too. My mum was a bit of a rebel.
Yeah.
But that's a conversation we could have in a bit.
Yeah.
So Margot's great. Older sister of Daniel O'Donnell. But yeah. But she was a huge star. And if you listen to the arrangement of it, musically, as a musician, it's mind-blowing. The horn sections, everything is just top-notch. So give me a bit of Margot.
Okay, if we only had Ireland over here, Margot.
I was dreaming of old Ireland and Killarney's lakes and fells. I was dreaming of the shamrock and the dear old Shandon bells. When my memory suggested in a vision bright and clear of the strange things that would happen if we had old Ireland. The Blarney Stone stood out on Sydney Harbour, and Dublin Town to Melbourne came to stay. If the Shannon River joined the Brisbane waters, and Killarney's lakes flowed into Botany, the Shandon bells rang out in old Fremantle, and Paddy Cork at Adelaide did appear. Aaron's sons would never roam, all the boys would stay at home, if we only had old Ireland over of lovely fairies dancing on the village green. There are lots of lovely colleens, the finest ever seen, where the boys are all called Paddy and the girls called Molly dear. Sure we'd wrap the green flag round them if we had old Ireland. Shandon bells rang out in old Fremantle, and Paddy Cork at Adelaide did appear. Aaron's sons would never roam, all the boys would stay at home, if we only had old Ireland over here. If we only
If we only had old Ireland over here, that's the choice of Mike Walsh. Dr. Mike Walsh, then, is it?
Not yet.
No. When do you become a doctor?
I don't know. I think they're marking my corrections tomorrow.
Okay.
So I'm sat there going, I've just put it out of my head.
Sorry for bringing it up.
No. Funnily enough, that all nostalgic thing, because I did stuff on Northern Spain, which we can talk about in a bit. But there is an academic, currents of starting to look at things like country and Irish music,
okay,
and what was going on in Irish families in Britain in the homes, and that idea of nostalgia. You know, Margaret, so if we only had Ireland over here,
yeah,
those songs are hugely nostalgic,
of course, yeah,
and comforting to some,
yeah.
And then what that means and how people negotiated their Irishness. So there's a lot of interest in that now.
Yeah. I need to listen to the lyrics of that more, but the sentiment of that. What is it? Is it kind of saying they want, because it was saying that they want people to stay in Ireland, not people to go away?
No, it said like, when the Shannon bells ring out over Fremantle, so that it's talking like about
Australia. Anyway.
So it's talking about America, Australia, various places, and it's just saying if we only had old Ireland over here.
Yeah.
So and that's the thing. Chatting about that thing about how you adapt to the country that you're living in, and then how you negotiate that and how your children negotiate that. We're just saying that. Well, Mark goes on. Yeah,
yes. Because I wasn't listening to lyrics, I was talking to you about all that.
I'm so
fascinated. So that's what we're talking about, really, is about your life and growing up as I suppose as a teenager in school years, and and I suppose how Irish you felt at that point. But
yeah, I'm just saying I would have. So there was me and my sister, and I would have been very much involved in Irish things, loved. I would have loved the sort of the culture, the dancing, the music.
Going Gaelic to football.
Oh God, no! It's me mincing around the Gaelic football team. I'm also dyspraxic. No, no, they'd pick I don't know, a coat before they pick me. Me in sports. I did have 2 years in professional sports, which we could talk about later. Bizarrely,
talk about it now. Come on, you've got to just leave that one. Go on.
So for 2 years, I worked for Manchester City Football.
So you weren't actually playing sports.
No. They chose me specifically. So this was the period of time when they were moving. Manchester City were moving from Main Road
in Moss Side.
Yes, to East Manchester. A big part of the funding for the Commonwealth Games stadium that they were moving into was the community legacy.
Yeah.
So I was brought in after working for Irish Community Care for a number of years, where I met you, to rationalise all the educational, community and charitable activities. So the fact that I wasn't starstruck, I wasn't a Manchester City fan, because I had to say to players, no, you can't be doing that. Yeah. That's a distraction, get with your training, all start doing charitable stuff. You had to rationalise everything.
Yeah.
So, and then relations with supporters clubs.
Yeah.
So I did that for 2 years.
Jumping about. I just thought I heard it. You saying you were a professional sports person.
No, I worked in professional. But I say that to the kids because they just laugh at me. They go, "Dad, you're just making stuff up again." Yeah. But I did. I worked for Manchester City for 2 years, which was really interesting.
Dad, no, that'd be an amazing job. But we have jumped about.
Yes, we have. Let's go.
But to get to that stage, so let's go back to childhood and teenage years. So you were kind of heavily involved in that. You embraced the Irishness and your sister didn't. Is that kind
Yeah. So like, but they were never forced. So none of it was forced. We were given the opportunity, and I think it's a really healthy thing. So my sister sort of went, no. Yeah. And interestingly, in years gone by, she's years later, she's very much into keeping the family together and the connections and keeping with the cousins and doing the family history, which I'll be drawing on at my next album. Yeah. So she's brilliant. So she's connecting in a different way, whereas mine was very out there, performative,
doing it.
Yeah. Playing music, going to activities, going to the Flowers, the music competitions with St Wilfrid's.
So what you got? Where? Which Flowers did you go to? What cities?
So we would have gone to Northern Region Flowers, the All Britain Flowers, the All Islands.
So did you go to Ireland?
We would have gone to Ireland as well. Yeah. So I think we was. And we went with St Malachy's. So I played with St Malachy's Senior Ceilidh Band. That was about 1986, 1987. And we won the All Britain. And we played.
Wow.
And it's like a blur. You go on stage in the big sort of dome thing. And
So these are all school kids' age, is it?
That one I was playing very young. I was about 16 then, but I was playing in the Senior Ceilidh Band. But we were
so
doing
is that
it.
Any age? We have grown men and.
Yeah. So, but we would have done it. We would have gone from 10. Upwards, I would have been playing in Ceilidh bands and then solos. I wasn't the best musician. I was like I'm fairly competent now, but I was a slow learner. Like I was saying to you before, Marion stuck with me, my teacher, and I just gradually, went on. But I loved it. I was so happy.
Yeah,
Saturday morning.
I mean, you can't not enjoy a Ceilidh, can you? Yeah. Did you have the shouter outer as well?
The caller, So the shelter outer. So we used to have someone doing that as well. But funnily enough, actually, not that often, because most people knew how to do the dances.
Yeah, obviously didn't.
So if you go to one of St Wilfrid's Ceilidhs, generally, if you're doing Siege of Ennis, Walls of Limerick, people know how to do that. High Call Cap, and you're getting some of the complicated Ceilidh dances a bit more difficult. But yeah, so that was a fabulous time, very much involved in it. Interesting time expressing your Irishness during the '70s when the bombs were going off in Manchester and the conflict.
Yeah. So we should say, what year were you born in?
I was born in 1967.
67, yeah. So you was kind of aware of the troubles and bombs going off stuff in your kind of teenage years were all happening, and then it, a bit later we had the Manchester bomb as well, wasn't it? 96.
I was working
at
Irish Community Care then.
That was when we met, wasn't it, around that time, wasn't it? But you were saying that some people, like we said, embrace it and kind of proud of the Irish, but others kind of not quite hiding away, but it's kind of integrating more into the kind of Englishness.
Yeah, I think it's a spectrum. So, yeah. Like, you get me, you go, no, I'm Irish, and, you know, try to work all that thing about your Irishness and your Englishness. My dad always said, make a hole out of two halves, always talks about how he's very passionate about his Irishness. Never changed his accent. My mum had a social services accent and a home accent. So, okay, like, she went to social services, she'd go, hello, it's Rose Walsh. And then it'd be Auntie Julia drink from Croftland. She'd go, ah, Julia! But Dad didn't need to because he worked in the building sites and he had this beautiful May accent. Anyway, so, yeah, a whole bit about negotiating identity, I think, and did quite a bit of work when I worked at Irish Community Care on, in fact, your dad, the great Con Keegan from Manchester Youth Service, supported me. I went and put an identity pack together and we worked in youth clubs and projects and we got people talking about their Irishness and the different levels of it. I think I found that there was a small group. It's not healthy to suppress a complete part of who you are.
Yeah.
And then that's bound to end up in neurosis. It's healthy to, integrate.
Yeah.
But I think it's good to acknowledge where
you're from. And that would be the same for any community, wouldn't it? Not just Irishness, isn't it? All communities that are kind of coming to the UK now in Sheffield, isn't it? It's important to...
I think what was interesting with the Irish community, and there was great academic Liam Greenslay wrote a paper called White Skin, White Mask. He was pulling on Fanon stuff.
Yeah.
So and it's that thing about when you get to a second, third generation, you're Irish, but you can't tell.
Yeah, yeah.
And so some people strategically go, right, I'm not going to say anything because it's just too dodgy here. And then the impact that has on that sort of almost like split personality.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I just was right out there.
And which was brave because, it kind of became a bit trendy to be Irish, didn't it?
Yeah.
Probably, I think the Pogues, when the Pogues started being brilliant... That's kind of from then on, it was kind of good to be Irish, I think.
It was changing. They redefined it. A lot of Irish people hated the Pogues. I remember when we were watching, they appeared on the Tube. It was famous on Channel 4. And I remember lovely Liz, our neighbour, family's from Monaghan. She's going, this is a disgrace. Disgrace to be a disgrace to Ireland, that. You know, like your man whacking his head with the beer tray and that. But that London Irish thing, very, very particular. Yeah. His experience, he was a public school boy as well. So his experience was very different to mine.
Yeah, of course.
I think.
Of course.
And I wasn't all that sure about the Pogues when they first came because I was like working really hard to play really nice music. And they were going, give me a tin whistle.
But kind of leading to your next song, one of the bands in Manchester, again, that we both saw, I don't know if we have to apologise to our audience for being self indulgent, but who cares? We're enjoying it. Talking about. But one of the bands that were great in Manchester at the time, we were Toss the Feathers.
Yeah.
And I think they were definitely influenced by the Pogues in terms of kind of, well, they play a lot of Pogue songs. I remember like Fiesta, Sally McMahon and all that. Yeah. They'd play that. But the fact they had a drummer and they had a bass player, that was directly from the Pogues. Would you agree? Or?
Some of it. I think they were more influenced by Celtic rock.
Yeah,
so they would have been, like the next chart we're going to play is from Stockton's Wing. And Stockton's Wing did the focused stuff, very trad stuff. And then two of the albums, they brought in bass and drums, sort of rock drums and that. So I think they would have looked to Stockton's Wing more, but Pogues too. And also people liked the Pogues, they would have sang songs that people liked.
Yeah, yeah, good. All right, let's play that one then. So The Mason's Apron, Stockton's Wing, a lovely tune. Thank you. Mason's Apron, one of my favourite tunes there. So that's Stockton's Wind's version. But it's a classic tune, isn't it? You'll hear quite a lot of sessions.
So there's a two-part one, and then there's a very flashy multi-part one that probably was made famous by Sean Maguire.
Right, yeah.
The Belfast virtuoso.
Yeah, thank you for that one, yeah. So we're here tonight live on Deserted Island Disc again, live in Sheffield, and it's Mike Walsh who's telling us about his life and picking some songs for us. So we're going to get you to Sheffield a bit. So I never knew that you went to Sheffield Uni as well, so that's news to me, yeah. So.
I went to, as I call it, Sheffield Poly for the harder thinking. God bless him. I went to both, actually.
Yeah.
So I went to Sheffield Poly, partly because it was the only place...
They let you in.
Let me in, because it was just really rubbish at school. God bless him. And there's a bloke...
Well, you had ADHD.
ADHD. It was a miracle.
Yeah.
And there was a bloke there called Mike Wild. I don't even know Mike. He's a musician and involved in... He was Sheffield City Morris and Tunes and South Riding Folk Network and all sorts of things. Anyway, his dad was Sam Wild, who was the leader of the... British Battalion in the Spanish Civil War from Manchester.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyways. So I got a message from first term at Sheffield Poly down in Totley. I got a message from my tutor, Mike Wild. Oh, he's not seen me much.
Yeah.
And I went in to see Mike and he went, oh, no, no. He said, I'm sorry, I've been a bit distracted. And he said, no, he said, I'm always interested to see that you play Irish music and I've not seen you in Fagin's.
All right.
So it was his way of drawing me in a little bit. Anyway, so I started going to Fagin's and met Tom Bolden and then Maurice Malone used to sing in there. It was all that era and it was lovely. So there was a
Tuesday night.
This would be 1988.
Right,
1989.
Yeah.
And it was great. Tom was a real role model. He sort of like really mentored me and looked after me. Nice. Worked behind the bar. If he had any worries, I'd have a chat with gin and tonic with him after. Right. A great, great man. Huge time for him and an amazing singer.
Yeah.
And he was great at curating a night. Yeah. You know, he could make magic things happen. And I loved it as well because I love Fagin's because it wasn't just tunes. Like Tuesday night was tunes. Pat Walker used to do great tunes and Brian and... So some great musicians used to come through, but I loved it because some nights it'd just be singing, or you didn't know what you'd get.
Yeah, exactly.
I think I was just saying to you before, I remember one afternoon Richard Hawley wandered in. This is before he worked there briefly. Richard Hawley and his cousin, they came in singing Everly Brothers songs. You just never knew who would turn up. And I loved it. And then for me, ADHD head, it was great. So I'd play a few tunes, then someone would sing a song, and then someone could...
Getting bored, are you?
No, I wouldn't. If it was just tunes all night, I'd wander off. I'm better at it now, obviously. But Fagin's was my real home. Got to know people, made friends for life. I'm still in touch with people, and I moved back here in the end.
So was that related? Let's just do Sheffield then. It's difficult just to do Sheffield because there's so much happened in between, wasn't there?
So Sheffield, I was here till 1996. Worked at the Children's Festival for a bit as well.
So you stayed after you finished your course, obviously.
Yeah, I just had a great old time. Didn't want to leave.
So you might as well stay here,
Didn't want to leave. And in the end, I felt like it'd come to an end. And then I went over to Manchester and did the development plan for the new Irish Centre.
Yeah.
Always longed to come back to Sheffield. Loved it. Loved coming over. And then I met my wife.
Go on, tell us about that.
Met my wife. Right, random. After coming back from Donegal... I was director of the youth service there, got a bit burned out, walked across Spain, came back, a lad called Dave Koski, who's a brilliant guitar player, he messaged me and he said, "Well, see, I've not seen you for ages, we're having a party on New Year's Eve," and it was up at Rusby Towers, Kate Rusby and Joe, and they've got a recording studio in the house. So I went up there, just thought, a load of my mates were away from Manchester, thought, No harm. Went up when it was a Downton Abbey party.
Okay.
So I like to go the full route. So I went to the Royal Exchange costumiers and they did the full tall bowler hat and the morning suit.
Yeah.
And then they had one of them woolly striped Edwardian bathing costumes. So don't get excited there at home too much. And so I wandered in, never been in them before. I had my full costume on and no one was dressed.
Perfect.
Anyways, we stayed there for the weekend, met my wife there, Sarah, her family. She's a great, she knows all them lot from English folk music, great dancer and sword dancer, Morris dancer, musician. She's a great, my wife. Met her there and fell in love. And
yes.
That was it then. And then we decided, when we were having kids, she lived in Aberdeen.
Okay.
And I lived, she's a
so you was doing long distance from Manchester to Aberdeen, was it?
I was going up to see her in Aberdeen. She
and
was
you
coming
in Manchester.
Down. Yeah. And then we thought, well, we need to find somewhere we're going to live. And then we decided to live in Sheffield. Her family are from Sheffield. Her mum was brought up in Beechief. And her grandma and grandpa were very influential, Gordon and Nora Hunter. They were very involved in the folk scene. So Gordon always had the EFTUS record stall at anything,
okay.
any events. He was involved in the Hefts and Blades folk club, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I just went, right, yeah, Sheffield.
Yeah, well, you'd love Sheffield anyway.
Yeah.
And she had that concert, made sense.
Yeah, came back and we've been here 14 years now.
And they kids now?
Kids got Oscar. He's 11, 12 in a few weeks' time. He's a bit of a Yorkshire lad. He plays his brass.
All right, yeah.
He's just started on the melodeon, and it's Celeste is 13, 14 soon. And they're involved in the folk dancing, like the rapper sword dancing and all that kind of stuff. In fact, they set up a team themselves after Whitby Folk Week last year, and they entered the Dance England Rapper Tournament, and they won it for the first time.
Fantastic.
So they're English champions. So no Irish music, but that's fine.
Yeah.
They're busy, they love it, and they're passionate about it.
So that sounds nice. Did you take the whole family to Whitby Folk Week, did you?
So Sarah's family have been going since it started, 50-odd years ago, every year. So it's like, we're going to Whitby Folk Week, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
You can go to somewhere else. So I remember I went the first year, after about a day, I was going, oh God, this isn't like the Flowering Island, what is this, like that. And then it's an interesting place because you've got the regatta, so you got all the people coming from Middlesbrough, it's a real mix. And I thought, well, there's no point sulking because this is going to be part of my life. And got involved in it, loved it, I've done workshops and we've done gigs there, done album launches there, love it, it's great. And the kids, like, we've got to go there every year.
It's good. I've never been, Mike.
You should go.
I need
Fabulous.
To go this year. I'm doing it August, isn't it?
For a week.
I'll
I'm going to be there, going to be, should be, not signed the thing yet, we should be teaching and doing some gigs.
Okay, good. Talking of teaching, it's time for you to do a whistle song for us.
A whistle tune.
So do you want to introduce it? And also, is it kind of what you might do if someone came to one of your lessons? You can plug your lesson again in case someone's just joined us.
Right, so I'm going to play the first jig I ever learnt, and it's called Paddy's Return. So this is a very simple tune. I still play it, and it's if you want to listen to my album Quayhawk, which is an all good streaming services, and you can buy them from me. Anyways, I play a lot of the tunes that I learnt at St Wilfrid's on the album. So this is one of the tunes. So if you came to a lesson, you could learn this. So Paddy's Return. Are you going to dance?
Yeah.
Right, okay. You ready?
Yeah. I love it. Fantastic. It's brilliant.
Brilliant. How can you talk after dancing?
No, I'm very fit. I'm very fit.
Well done, Ben. It's lovely. Light on your feet.
I was tapping away. That was it. Nodding my head. No, it was lovely, that. Really nice. Really kind of clear tunes, isn't it? It's like a nice sound. Well done. You're pretty good. So, I wanted to kind of come back to your kind of work career. And I think like most people, I think I certainly did it myself, is that kind of in your, I suppose, 20s and 30s, you kind of have a thing where you're just kind of going from job to job, kind of looking for a better paid job, going up the career ladder. Mm-hmm. That sounds like what happened. And so you got a great job, but this is where I first met you, doing the Irish Community Care. So that was like... Like you said, it was the new Irish Centre, but then after that, you were kind of basically just like helping anyone from the Irish community in Manchester with whatever they needed. And how we met was Mike would bring down homeless people, basically, people who were in the Irish community that were stuck for somewhere to live. You'd take them to the council or wherever they needed help. And I suppose you'd do whatever was needed, wasn't it? You'd kind of find out what support people needed and do
yeah.
it.
Yeah, so you worked at Direct Access, which was the way to bring people who were homeless. Classically, what would happen is usually on a Friday, someone would get kicked out of Ireland, either at the time because of paramilitaries.
Yeah, drug dealers, you did some of that, didn't you? Yeah,
drug dealers. Or they'd be on the run from the guards, or they'd just be a bit lost, or whatever.
Yeah.
And they'd arrive, and of course, they'd go to various places, and they would use any of those terms that I've just used, and people would panic quite rightly a little bit, but you didn't. And then I would go, okay, how do we sort this out? And they wouldn't have any identity, so they couldn't get an insurance number, so most places wouldn't be able to take them because they wouldn't get benefits. So I would sort of try and calmly deal with the crisis situation, bring them down to you, we'd sort out whatever we could, and then get them going, basically. And then we work with a network of organisations throughout Ireland to sort of help them. So we could ring places and say, do you know this person? Can you help us get some ID?
Yeah.
And then also we had Sister Elizabeth, this nun, who was great. So I'd do me like touchy-feely, lovely youth work stuff. And then if I wasn't getting a response, she'd go in.
Yeah.
I'd bring in the nuns. No, because what she did was she was a head teacher of a school in West Belfast for years, so she knew every family, everyone, and she was from Dublin, so she knew everyone. So if they weren't, she'd go in and she'd get the truth.
Yeah,
10 minutes, she'd go, right, sorted it. Yeah, anyway, so it's a brilliant team, it's good.
Yeah.
So that stuff, and then I went to Manchester City.
So that was a kind of, I mean, that's like saying that's that career thing, it's a better job, more excitement, and better job.
I think with some community organisations, they're going waves.
Yeah.
And I think it felt like my boss was going, and it felt like I had finished the projects that I'd done. So it's time to move on.
And that was another great project for the wrong team, but it still did good work.
It's brilliant. And that was the reason, not so much more money, but I could see that the difference they made in terms of social inclusion.
Yeah.
I was pretty passionate about that, and their community work in Manchester City was really good.
Yeah.
So did that, did all the stuff, the stadium move, mind-blowing, all the stuff to do with end of an era stuff and moving to the new stadium, the Barcelona match.
The last game, very often,
I'd turn up and people thought I was Mickey Walsh, the ex-Ireland international. And me and Alex Williams, who was a
goalkeeper.
And amazing man, a black guy, and I dealt with a lot of crap in his time, but he was very gentle. So me and him were a great team. So we'd turn up at supporters clubs, and they knew Alex Williams was, and they were expecting Mickey Walsh from Norwich, and they'd see me, and they'd go, so, yeah. Anyway,
it's not your fault, is it?
No, they laughed. Everyone was very nice. And then went to Ireland.
So you just kind of saw this job, or the projects with City Biz done, and kind of...
Well, I'd done the stadium move, and then my boss, who was the chief executive, left. There was a bit of a boardroom tiff.
Okay.
And I just thought, the person I want to work for has gone now. So I applied for a job in Ireland, thought, give it a go.
Yeah.
And I got it. I was like, So I was director of a regional youth service, which was a charity.
Yeah.
And it was sort of Peace process.
It's Donegal.
It was Donegal.
Which is obviously on the border.
Yeah, it's like Kenny. So there was a lot of cross-border work. Funnily enough, I'd been involved in that stuff through the Irish community and the Irish in Britain and Stranthrey, the peace process. So we'd done the lobbying going over to bring...
So it helped for the job interview.
So we knew that, that stuff, but it was a whole different kettle of fish. The cross-border stuff and bringing people together and... a lot of money was brought into a region that had felt cut off and isolated for a long time.
So in Donegal, would there be many Protestants there?
But they would have decreased.
Yeah.
Over the years, but they would. Some of the members of the staff would have been Presbyterian.
So was the work kind of? I suppose is Derry's kind of near Donegal, is it? Is that the kind
of... Yes, you'd go over to Derry, but would work throughout the north. And
so would you work in in Derry or Northern Ireland?
The projects would work with projects in the north. Across borders. So these are peace and reconciliation projects.
So you're working in both.
So there was, and it was interesting. So a lot of people in rural Donegal wouldn't have been aware of the impact of the war or the troubles or whatever you wanted to call it. Interesting, when we did a project writing, and we got some of them, and some of the kids who were sort of talking about loss, and they would talk about they'd lost a doll, and then you might get a kid who's from an area where there's a lot more activity problems would talk about some really distressing stuff too. So there's a lot of people who felt very cut off, very disenfranchised. Donegal had been cut off because of the border closures.
It's a bit of a cul-de-sac up there, isn't it?
So quite a lot of anger, and a lot of money came in, and it was an interesting job to manage. And I left it in a really good shape, but it didn't leave me in a good shape.
So no, you weren't in good shape. I'm conscious, Mike, that we haven't really got loads of time, and I know this is a really kind of important part of your life, and I don't think we'd probably do it full justice if we kind of skipped on it. But no. I think just to kind of say, it was life changing for you in terms of that kind of moving away from that kind of career chasing stuff. You kind of had a reset. Is that fair enough?
It was critical. So even though it was tough, everyone was angry, there was a lot of shouting, and when you're the director or the chief executive, you've got to take that. I just got burnt out. And I had a severe depressive episode. And looking back, I realise now it was ADHD, basically. And was burnt out. I was trying to do all these things, and had gone from being very secure in Manchester, even in Manchester City, there was a lot of resources.
Well, you had your friends and family around
And had a really supportive chief executive for the club I was working directly to, brilliant, and then Alex Williams, who worked with, brilliant. And then I went to Donegal, and I was the sort of the face of it. It probably didn't help me the first week I went. They said Michael Walsh signs from Manchester City. He was on the front of the Donegal Democrat. So they thought, hey, that fella's got notions, But, anyways, so I got burnt out, and I took time out, and... one of the things I found out while I was there was about the Camino de Santiago. Quite a few people had done it there. My ex there had done it. And I'm very grateful for finding out about that. So I thought, I'll do it.
So it's a pilgrimage?
It's a pilgrimage.
Across Northern Spain?
A number of pilgrimage routes. You can walk from Canterbury if you wanted.
Right.
But so I was very out of shape, very tired, very exhausted, mentally just whacked. I just... went, well, I'll go. So I got a train to...
On your own?
I just got a train to Paris, and then I got an overnight train to down to Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, which is on the border with France and Spain. And I arrived, I had no idea, and then lovely, it went to the... They had these albergues, refuges, and the lovely man there said, I don't think you're ready for this. Give yourself a day.
Yeah.
Because he could see I was flustered, and it was lovely, and he was quite right. And just set off walking, and I walked from Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port across Spain. It's about 800 kilometres to Santiago de Compostela in Galicia, and then I walked to Finisterre, which is like they say, if you look out from Finisterre's Tir an Og, it's the land of forever young. Yeah. Looking from there. By the time I got to Finisterre, I was a lot fitter, a lot happier, and I had a...
So how long did that take?
It took 6 weeks.
6 weeks, yeah. So yeah. A good time out, yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. And so it was critical for me, got me fit, made me, give me a perspective in life, which I hold on to still now.
Yeah, yeah.
While I was walking, I met an American lad called Zach, brilliant, brilliant lad, who ended up on it by accident. He was just travelling.
Yeah.
So we hit it off, and we're still mates today. We were walking across, and he met this woman who was from Asturias in northern Spain, which is next to Galicia. So if you think about Spain, you've got Portugal on the left,
yeah.
You've got Galicia over the
on
top.
The top bit, yeah.
And you turn right, and the next bit there is Asturias.
Okay.
So he met his wife, who was from Asturias.
On the walk.
Yeah. And then I'd heard some Asturian music,
yeah.
Tejador, and I went to their wedding.
Yeah.
And while I was there, I met all these musicians. I was wandering around this little town, and I heard this music. I was like, what's that?
Yeah.
And I followed it into a bar. And actually, they were playing Michael McGoldrick from Manchester.
Yeah.
He was in Toss we were Feathers, talking yeah, Toss Feathers, yeah. And he was on Tejador's album
yeah,
as well.
And yeah.
It went on to co-produce my album. And he's in everything. He's
yeah,
in,
yeah.
What's it called, from...
Yeah, yeah, he's still doing it well now, isn't he?
Yeah,
we
yeah.
are running short of
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
I do want to get... Well, what we'll have to do, mate,
mm-hmm.
just to make sure we get in, is play one of your songs, and it's a favourite one of my one
yeah.
of yours that I love, The Visitor. But you just introduce that.
Yeah.
And I know we might not finish what you're saying, but...
That's fine. No, let's get The Visitor. This is one of my favourites too. So, change of life, and decided to do an album during the album process. My dad... got killed,
yeah.
he sadly drowned, and it opened up a whole load of creativity.
Wow.
And this track I heard in my head,
yeah.
And I could hear there's a poet called Mike Garry, who a lot of people might have seen with John
yeah,
Cooper
yeah.
Clarke,
yeah,
etc.
He's fantastic.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I knew him, and I just said, could you do some words, because I couldn't find the words to express how I felt about my dad. And this is Mike McGoldrick, me, and Mike Garry. Three mics.
It's beautiful.
The Visitor for James Hugh Garry. My father is with me. He visits me, calls to me from the dark, plays tricks, turning lights on and turning lights off, changing channels on TV. Once, when I was sleeping, he shaved my eyebrow. I could feel the warm water drips from his fingertips. Soft, slow, scraping blade, the dabbing of his off-white handkerchief, and a kiss so soft, it might never have happened. My father was a fighter, hands like bricks, buckets for fists, heart of fire glowing, golden flowing. And he loved the best he could, for he knew little of love, and hungered the most basic of things, the very fundamentals, the glue that binds the heart and soul together. But he did the best he could, and I believe he loved. My father was a dancer, feet like leaves on a breeze. He'd glide in and out and in and out and in. and he stole the heart of my mother with a single waltz. Mesmerized her eyes and mind with a single dance, and she swears she floated that night just above the dance floor. And by the look in her eyes when she told me, she was probably right.
That's Mike Walsh, Mike Garry, and who's the
Michael McGold. Oh, sorry, Michael McGold is doing the sound effects.
Okay.
And it's Liz Hanks from Sheffield who's on with your man Richard Hawley. Anything from Sheffield with a cello on, it's Liz Hanks.
Okay. So yeah. She's playing cello on that, and then you're obviously playing the flute on that, yeah. Which is beautiful, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, fantastic track. It's beautiful. And that's, you're saying that gets played on Radio 2?
Radio 2, that's brought me to places that my music wouldn't have been played. That's, I've just sent it, got played in some avant-garde program, someone heard it, and then I've got commissioned to do something with a project that's coming out later on in the year on the Undertones, bizarrely, their record label. So yeah, you just never know. Anyways, the point with that though for me is it helped me heal.
It's about your dad. Yeah. And it's great words, isn't it, Mike? Mm-hmm. Puts to it, it's yeah. There, yeah. So yeah, we're running out of time. You're going to finish the show with a song.
Yep.
Yes, we're not quite ready for yet. So just tell us a bit more about the future. So you mentioned you're going to record some more stuff. Is it? Is that the plan? Or
well, that's record. So there's a project called Bring Your Own Hammer, which is a group of academics from around the world who are interested in 19th century Irish history. And they do song cycles, so they just did a song cycle last year, but this one they've commissioned me to do two pieces. I have one piece and then I'm playing on another piece, and we're doing it about Scuttlers, which were a 19th century street gang which caused the moral panic which led to the Boys Club movement and Manchester City being formed.
Okay.
And it's a snappy 9-minute thing, right. And it's going to be released on Dimple Discs.
Okay.
So it's bizarre, and then I'm playing another track with the Undertones guitarist.
Wow.
Like me playing a slow air and there's them thrashing.
Yeah. Just... Oh, fantastic. So so life's good, generally? You're in a good place these days? And
life is very good. I'm glad I enjoyed bringing up my kids, staying at home. That was brilliant. I've enjoyed doing the PhD. There's some other research projects. The PhD may end up as a television documentary, but that's a work in progress. So there's a lot of lovely stuff coming up. I enjoy being at home with the kids. I enjoy teaching. This stuff's coming out that we've recorded. That'll be out later on the year. That's why I'm growing a beard, because we've got to do a video in about 3 months.
It's not going very well, is
I've
it?
I've got to be an old man in the west of Ireland. So,
okay. Yeah. Anyway. Hurry up and grow it.
So, yeah, it's great. Love not leaving Sheffield. Love it. But I feel like Sheffield, everything's possible. It feels like the world is waiting for
it's
you.
It's great. We've rambled on about Manchester, yeah. But we both love
that's
Sheffield,
right,
don't
here.
We? We're both yep. Here, aren't we?
It's my home.
So, yeah, Mike, go on. You're going to play us a song. We'll see if we've got time to say goodbye, but if not, this might be the end of the night. So thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy and a pleasure.
You're most welcome, Ben. Thank you.
And tell us about the song.
Quick
before
song.
You start
yeah,
playing.
This is a song called It's the Shores of Loch Bran. It's an emigration song written from the perspective of a man who imagines what his neighbour is feeling his neighbour Brock feels when he's going to America. And it's a song that my Uncle Frankie used to sing when he was a bit drunk, but he'd forget the words, so I decided to learn it
okay.
fully, and I dedicated to him. On the album, it's sang in three languages, Irish, Asturian, and English, and it reflects that the experience in rural communities of migration are similar, whether it's in Asturias, whether it's in Ireland, or whether it's in England too.
Okay.
So have a listen to that, but this is the...
The
English-ish version,
okay.
English language version, but I'm playing a Halusi, which my wife bought back from Japan. And when it was noodling about in the studio, Mike McGoldrick went, that's brilliant, that'll save us doing the Ilian pipe. So here we go. Shows a lot, Bram. Sit you down, loyal comrades, sit you down for a while. For I've spent my last hour on Erin's green isle. Come fill up your glasses and we'll drink hand to hand. For tomorrow I'll be leaving my home by Loch Bran. No more will I wander through Farner's green fields, and the place I love fondest, the bound by the mill, and the green fertile valleys where so oft times I ran to embrace those sweet breezes by the shores of Loch Bran. There's my father and mother, I can still hear them cry, and the tears and bewailing would moisten your eye. But I will attend them, please God, if I can. Far, far from lovely Erin and the shores of Loch Bran. On the incoming morning,